Right, welcome everyone to a huge week in the world of golf. For us golf nerds, this is the best week that only comes around every 2 years. All eyes are on Rome as we're getting ready to enjoy the beauty that is Ryder Cup golf. The Americans may fancy themselves as favourites given what happened last time, but the bookies have just made the Europeans a slight favourites to hold the Americans off. They haven't won on European soil since 1993. The big narrative coming into the week is probably that the Americans have a slightly better team on paper, given that they won comfortably last year. But I think you're a brave man or woman to bet against Luke Donald's European side. Joining me to preview this Ryder Cup is a full house with Dave O'Connor, Joe Nealon and Cooper Nolan. Cooper, you're on the ground in Rome. Give us a little bit of a sense of what it's like over there.
Yeah, there's great buzz around the place. A lot of Yanks, actually. Maybe that's just Rome in, Rome in September anyway, but I'd say a lot of them, if they were over playing golf in Scotland or Ireland, have added this to the itinerary. I got a flight over yesterday. I wasn't on the course yesterday for the first practice round. Heading out this morning, but it was a good group of European lads in their blue waistcoats and yellow hats with the protectors of the cup or guardians of the cup stitched into the back. So there's definitely going to be a few diehards. I was chatting to them. They've been to, I think it's each of the last 11 Ryder Cups, in Europe and in the US. So that's what I want to be when I grow up. But, I think the sport from the UK and Ireland anyway is fairly apparent. Haven't seen kind of I've been meeting a few Spanish lads later on as well that I know from home, and it'll be interesting to see how much Italians are on the course as well. But yeah, generally, like, Rome is just infrastructure wise it's a perfect place to hold something like this, in terms of being able to actually cope with a massive amount of people in one space. And yeah, looking forward to getting out on the course, because geez, from any of the videos we saw of day one in the practice range, it looks like it's in absolutely perfect nick, and the weather is absolutely A1. So yeah, buzzing.
Beauty. Dave, what's your overriding feelings or emotions coming into this one? What are you thinking about?
What am I thinking about? I'm thinking about hopefully a European win, obviously, but I think it's really shaping up nicely to be one of the most competitive and tight Ryder Cups in a number of years. I think both teams are very well set up. I think, you know, the fact that you said earlier or at the start there that Europe are now favourites in the bookies speaks volumes about how Donald's team has shaped up over the past probably 3 months in particular. I think if you'd have said to us at the start of the season that Europe would be coming into this Ryder Cup as strong favourites, you'd nearly be, well, not even strong favourites, but favourites of any description, you would nearly be thinking that the US had some sort of injuries or something like that, because at the beginning of the year, it really was a concern from a European perspective. And obviously, it's easy to forget with everything that's happened in golf over the last couple of years, but like, Donald wasn't even the captain at the beginning of this cycle. Like, there's been a huge amount of upheaval and a huge amount of change in the team as well from 2 years ago. Like, Ludvig Åberg wasn't someone who was on a lot of people's horizons, you know, even 6 months ago. Obviously, he's now made the team. So I think the story for me coming into the week is the upward trajectory that Europe is on, and whether that will actually translate to the golf course or not. I think, you know, there's a lot of talk obviously around all sorts of events like this, you know, and things get overhyped, and there's like a clear It's a clear like media overhaul about these things, but I think ultimately it comes down to your big players. And there was a lot of talk at the time of the picks about the likes of Mronk being left out and this, that, and the other. But ultimately, I think it comes down to your big players, and I think that for Europe in particular, that means McIlroy, Ram, and Hovland. And I think that those guys have been, in good form more or less all year, and in Hovland's case, has been in exceptional form coming over the last 5 to 6 weeks. And I think if Europe are actually going to cash in on the favoritism, those guys are going to have to continue what they've been doing for the last, as I say, 3, 4 months, and get points on the board for Europe.
Joe, Dave just mentioned there those top European lads like your Rory, Ram, Hovland. You could make the argument that Europe are stronger at the top than the Americans are, but then clearly the Americans have greater depth. I mean, if you look at the bottom players on Europe, you're talking Nicolai Højgaard, you're talking Bob McIntyre, whatever, versus the bottom players in America are like. Justin Thomas, who's double major champion, and the likes of your Wyndham Clark, Brian Harman's that have won majors this year. What do you think in terms of European top heavy versus the Americans having better depth?
Yeah, like I think you spot on, because Europe have three of the top four in the world in Hovland, McIlroy, and Ram. So straight away that jumps out. I think with that in mind as well, it probably means that for the Sunday singles, it would be ideal if we weren't down, given, I think on paper, as you said, there are a couple of our weaker players. If they come up against some of the, the average US player, it'll be tough. But it is the same always in the Ryder Cup. It's always on paper the US team are higher ranked. They've always got, an average world ranking in and around 9-10, and I think it's no different this time. I think Fowler's their lowest ranked player, 24. So on paper is a lot different to, reality though as well. I think and being able to pick the eight best guys for the first 2 days over the, obviously the two sessions on each day. I think when you do pick those top eight lads as well, everything sort of leans me towards thinking Europe have a very good chance here. And it's funny, like as Dave was saying before, like we would almost scoffed at that idea. But I think you also can't overstate the importance of the home crowd, given like the US obviously haven't won in 30 years on foreign soil. And I think since 1983, I saw that out of the 19 meetings, five have only been won away. So, there's 14 home wins there in that grouping. So the crowd will have a massive telling and impact, I think, on how this goes. And yeah, it'll just be interesting to see though how some of those lower ranked guys handle it as well. Like I can't see, for example, McIntyre playing more than one session before the Sunday singles. I think he'll probably get thrown out in a four ball on maybe the Friday afternoon. But if that doesn't go very well, you mightn't see him till Sunday. Players like Højgaard as well, question marks about him, given the exclusion of Mronk from the team. Will he kind of feel that pressure? I don't think Åberg will feel that pressure. I think he's just a different level altogether. Obviously showed a bit of fragility there at Wentworth on the final day. Had a bad day after going out leading. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how those guys handle it, because we've all seen the scenes of Paris in 2018 on the first tee, the Icelandic clap from the Euros kind of adopted by the Europeans. And it's going to be electric, and I suppose if you handle it well, it'll be great. But if you don't, it could be, it'll make for great drama for us anyway, regardless.
The home advantage thing is very interesting. I would have always looked at the home advantage thing. Obviously, the crowd is a big factor, and I would have thought that the golf course is set up a little bit in your favor. But I was watching a couple of things. Firstly, I was watching some video the other day where it was documenting what they did in Le Golf National. And I didn't really know all that much, saying that they identified that the Americans were better from, I think, 150 yards and in. So they created all these bottlenecks on the golf course. They grew the rough up thick, and then they pushed the crowd back 2 or 3 yards, which I thought was real interesting. So that if Americans were obviously in way wider off the tee, that they wouldn't have trampled down grass. And obviously we live in this world where there's just so much data available. And I think those stats are probably reasonably similar now. But then, so that was the first thing. And then the second thing around the golf course, I was watching something Paul McGinley was saying, that years ago, there was like a gentleman's agreement that the home team wouldn't set up the golf course that much. And but then behind like the opposition's back, that they were clearly setting up the golf course in a way that suited the home team. But in recent years, they've actually formalized that to say that, well, we know you're going to set up the golf course in a way that suits your team. So it's now just like open and agreed upon. So the Europeans, Luke Donald, will have spent the last, well, however long, helping the superintendent, their greenkeepers, creating a golf course that suits the Europeans much better. I think, yeah, I don't know. I just thought that was very interesting with course setup.
Yeah, I think that's the key home advantage. I think the crowd can be a factor, obviously, but I think it can be overplayed ultimately, because these guys are, you know, they're the top players in the game. They're, a lot of them are going to be in their own bubbles irrespective of what the crowd is doing. I mean, I think Speech yesterday was saying that he played a lot with Patrick Reed in previous Ryder Cups, and that used to kind of drive Reed on. But like, Speech was basically saying that to him, it's just water off a duck's back if you know, if someone in the crowd says something to him, or if you know, if there's cheers going up. But
what a weird combination, by the way, Speech and Reed.
Yeah, it was often. Well, I think it was a bit, when it came to Patrick Reed, it was a bit like, you know, square peg round hole, trying with everyone, and just Speech obviously was someone who agreed to play with him. But of course, Reed threw his toys out of the pram in 2018 when Thomas arrived on the scene, and Speed and Thomas became the obvious pairing from then on. So, you know, I'd say there's plenty in the European team room this week that are more than happy that Reed isn't there, even though he did actually have quite a good Ryder Cup record, to be fair to him. But just back on the course setup, like, I think that is the key home advantage. And I think that, you know, Le Golf National is an excellent example of that. But apparently the rough in Marco Simeone this week isn't actually as tricky as it was in Le Golf National. Like, I think you'll see videos online of, one of my least favorite things that these golf Twitter boys do when they go to golf courses, and you see it at majors as well, is the rough drop video, where they just take a ball and just drop it directly from about 12 inches above the rough, and it just sinks to the bottom. And like, it gives the impression that, like, you know, Tiger Woods with a you know, shovel, never mind a wedge, wouldn't get it out of it. Like, it's just ridiculous. But I then saw, you know, and when you actually take a step back, like, you saw like Sepp Straka, for example, yesterday hitting a wood out of the rough. So like, it's not going to be like, I think if you're absolutely off the charts, wild off the tee, there is some tick stuff. But like, you know, just, if you miss a fairway by 2-3 yards, you know, you're going to get a lie more often than not, and you're going to be able to hit a second shot. So I think that's been overplayed. But apparently, you know, the kind of second cut of rough isn't quite as bad as it was in Paris. And an interesting bit of data that popped up during the week is that when you actually take the sum of the parts of both teams, the US are actually slightly more accurate off the tee. According to Data Golf. Now, that's taking everyone's stats and bundling them all together, but it seems that, you know, the general kind of wisdom is that, oh, it'll suit the Europeans. And historically, this may have been the case, that it would suit them to have a narrow golf course, but it would seem that the data this time suggests that actually, on the whole, the US are actually a bit more accurate off the tee. So that might be part of why Donald has decided to kind of make it a little less penal off the tee. But it does look that if you are wild and, you know, you're missing fairways by 15, 20 yards, you are going to be in hay, which wouldn't be the case at a US Ryder Cup. So it is definitely it is definitely an important advantage, and I'm sure like that's just one aspect of it. I'm sure Donald will have the greens a bit slower than you would see them on the PGA Tour, because that's something that Europeans would be a lot more used to. Possibly not anymore, because obviously the vast majority didn't play their golf over there, but historically speaking, they would have been used to playing on slightly slower greens than the American guys, so that's something that might work into their advantage as well.
I think I saw Dave that one, that there was one video, I think it could have been like, it was a good account, like someone like no laying up, and they did this ball drop in the rough, and someone went out onto the course to see where it was. It was like a par four, and they would have had to literally shank it 140 yards off the tee to get to the place where they dropped the ball. Like, just fucking absolute con men.
It's nonsense. Like, I mean, they might as well just go over to the side of a lake and drop a ball in and go, look, there's water there. If the ball goes in here, you're fucked.
But they did, like, obviously with the Italian Open there, like, I don't think there's been any massive changes. There might have been a few bunkers added, fairways kind of narrowed, rough, kind of grown in certain places. But one really interesting thing that Donald has done is he's scrapped the traditional four ball to kick off the Friday. And he swapped it in for foursomes. And the idea is, according to him, that Europe wants to get off to a faster start, and statistically, historically, we're better at foursomes than four balls. So that is, I guess, a fundamental shift in how we've, I guess, yeah. It's been the first time it's been done since 1993, and I think we all know what fucking happened there the last time the US won on foreign soil, so maybe not a great omen. But yeah, definitely, as far as kind of format goes and actual changes to what, to be honest, what I thought was just the way it was done. I didn't realize the captains even had a fucking say in that. But yeah, it's
that's a very cracking one. I think going in foursomes like that in the first match, like, firstly, on the first tee, you're going to be shitting it, and the fact that you don't have a partner backing you up for a four ball, I think, makes it extra nerve wracking. Also, I think if you're the guy who's hitting the second shot, like from the fairway or from the rough or something, I don't know, I'd be far more nervous hitting my very first shot of the Ryder Cup rather than having a driver.
Yeah, there won't be any claps or fucking lads getting the crowd psyched up before they hit their shot when it's a fucking foursomes match instead of a four ball.
I wonder, is it not just the fact that, you know, historically speaking, Europeans have a slightly better record in foursomes than four ball, but also it probably makes it a little bit easier to get all 12 out on Friday, because you can kind of put your best eight out in the morning and then hope that you get some sort of a lead, and then it's kind of easier to rationalize bringing the likes of McIntyre and Højgaard, let's say, into a four-ball environment on the Friday afternoon. Because I think, you know, if you're to go from a European perspective, and I know we'll talk about pairings, you know, later on, but, like, I mean, for foursomes, it kind of, there are, like, at least six or seven, if not all eight, that stand out to me for who would play that, and that's kind of putting your best foot forward. Like, for example, like, Justin Rose, who, you know, is not the player he used to be fair, but, like, you know, he has an outstanding foursomes record in Ryder Cup. I think he's 7-2.
Complimenting Justin Rose,
it's very hard to ignore numbers, and, you know, 7 wins and 2 losses in the Ryder Cup. Now, he did have some good partners, I will say that, so, you know, maybe that had something to do with it, but, you know, I think, you know, for my mind, Rose is there to play two foursome sessions, unless he's playing lights out or people are struggling, and maybe then he might play the Saturday afternoon four ball. But I'd say Rose is there to play 2-4. Some sessions are kind of, you're getting your experience out on the course in the morning, hopefully building a lead, and then making it slightly easier to bring the likes of McIntyre and Højgaard into the frame on a Friday afternoon. Because I think that's one thing that, you know, Mr. Ryder Cup McGinley would talk about, was that what was very important for him was getting all 12 players out in the first day and making everyone feel part of it and making everyone feel like he had confidence in them. And I think, you know, Donald has probably come from that school of thought, having been part of Ryder Cup teams with him and also been, you know, around him as a vice captain as well. So
I'm a fan of that. I quite like the idea of getting everyone out onto the golf course before the singles. What do you think?
Not just that, but, like, get everyone out on the golf course before the singles, but get everyone out on the golf course on the first day. And take it from there then. And I think opening with foursomes makes it slightly easier to do that because you don't want to put, you want to put your best foot forward irrespective of the format in the morning session. And if the morning session is four balls, and then, for example, it doesn't go well for you, then it's kind of more difficult to rationalize putting out a Bob McIntyre or someone or a rookie of any description into a foursomes environment in the afternoon when perhaps you've lost the first session 3-1.
Yeah, like it happened last weekend with the Solheim Cup team. They did play foursomes first, but they lost 4-0 in the morning. And as a result, Pedersen came out afterwards and said that she had to play her strongest players from then on out. She just couldn't afford anything. She couldn't afford to be, I suppose, nice. And, you know, as a result, I think it was Hedwall didn't play till Saturday afternoon. She would have otherwise played probably Friday afternoon, but she missed the first three sessions. But Suzanne Pedersen just said she had to go with the strongest. So I think that there is definitely truth in that, you know, Europe will fancy getting a couple of points on Friday morning in that format. And yeah, people like Rose is so valuable having him in a format like that. Even something as simple as like being tolerant of someone else's golf ball if you're not used to playing with that ball. You know, some of the younger guys just mightn't be used to that. Whereas Rose, I'm sure, has been there, done that. And and foursomes just a whole other level of pressure as well. So yeah, I'm
sure. That's a good point, Joe. Jesus. Like, I wonder, is that actually taken into consideration? Actually the ball type for foursomes.
Yeah.
Well, with these guys, like they're so precise and like they're such number crunchers. Apparently Eduardo Molinari is a complete genius and does all the number crunching for the European team. But Larry was out with Straka yesterday, I think, and the two of those guys use Strixen. So, you know, it's not beyond the realms of possibility that that they could be paired together. Kind of a surprising foursomes pairing, but you know, with that in mind, it could be one he wants to go with.
The golf ball is an interesting one on like picking pairings. Do you think that's like, I suppose maybe that small percentage, as you say, Eduardo Molinari is crunching numbers and he's looking at all these different factors. I wonder when you're trying to weight the importance of these different factors, I wonder the type of golf ball you're using.
Was it not? I know it was Matt Fitzpatrick in 2021, and I want to say it was Hovland that Harrington had planned to play together in foursomes, and they just couldn't gel with the golf ball in the practice rounds, and then he ended up putting Fitzpatrick out in the morning session with Lee Westwood, and they got beaten. Well, obviously Fitzpatrick got beaten given that he has an horrendous Ryder Cup record.
He does not know how to win a Ryder Cup match. What has he played?
No,
in
half.
One of
them. He hasn't even got a half point. Five losses out of five from playing two Ryder Cups. That is something that, you know, will be playing on his mind, I'm sure. And it's something that he really needs to get that monkey off his back, because he should be one of Europe's top performers in Ryder Cups going forward. Like, he's amazing.
I hate how he carries himself. Like, he always at Ryder. Well, he's played two Ryder Cups. He played Hazeltine and then the last one. So obviously two Ryder Cups, which is tough. But I don't know. I always looked at him and said, like, I just didn't like the cut of his jib when he's playing in Ryder Cups. He's all drooped over, and there's certainly no buzz out of him. Like, I look at him and say, just give him a kick up the arse and say, come on, mate. Like,
dude, do you put him out? Do you put him out first fucking thing, or do you sit him in the foursomes?
No,
I put him out in foursomes.
Yeah, you got to put him out. He's a major champion at the end of the day. Exactly. He's got to get over this. And his game's very suited to foursomes, I would think. I wouldn't be surprised to see himself and Rose playing together in the open session. Mm-hmm. That would make a lot of sense to me as a pair. And I think, yeah, I know what you mean by Fitzpatrick's jib, but I guess he's just, that's kind of his manner on the golf course. And I guess he's, you know, he's not trying to be someone he isn't. So I think that one thing that really would annoy me or would really stand out to me with some of these guys, and you see it over the years, is people who it doesn't come naturally to, like, you know, the roaring up the crowd, and there's nothing worse than someone trying to force it.
Yeah.
Like, I'd rather just see Fitzpatrick just play his own game. And if that means that he looks dour and walks around like, you know, a lad who's got the weight of the world on his shoulders, then that's fair enough, as long as he's playing his best golf. But, you know, he's, as I say, like, since the last Ryder Cup, he's won a major championship. He's got Billy Foster on his bag, obviously one of the most experienced caddies in the world, and you know, plenty of Ryder Cup experience, including caddying for Seve at the Ryder Cup. It doesn't get much more special than that, I would imagine. And you know, God knows poor El Seve's ghost will be dragged out again to inspire the Europeans. So yes. You know, Foster might be able to offer some advice in that respect. Seve will never rest easy while the Ryder Cup is going on, that's for sure.
Yeah, I agree. They'll be milking that, Billy Foster and his many stories. But what was I going to say? Okay, pairings. You mentioned some potentials there, say Matt Fitz and maybe Rose. The one that I'm most excited to see if it happens is McIlroy Åberg. Apart from that, I don't know. Like, there's obviously so many permutations. What do you think? What pairings are you expecting to see, and what would you be excited to see?
Well, McIlroy's rumored. He in that group with Larry and Straka, he played with McIlroy, played in that with Fleetwood as well. And there seems to be a lot of consensus that that will be a pairing. I'd be very excited to see that. That'd be a hard pair to beat. Obviously, Fleetwood has a pretty strong record, and the last home one he performed brilliantly with his best mate Fran. Then. I think McIlroy could pair with Åberg potentially in four ball, but Hovland was playing with Åberg, so that's another one. And then the one that seems to be, you know, all indications is Rahm and Hatton. They played together the first two rounds of Wentworth at the BMW a couple of weeks ago, and then they played together at Whistling Straits in 2021 as well, when Garcia was rested for one game, so Rahm played with Hatton. So that could be that'd definitely be a fiery enough pairing, the two of those guys together, but a pretty strong one. That'd be from the Europeans, I think so. Yeah, would it be like Rahm, Hatton, Fleetwood, Rose, McIlroy? Sorry, Fitzpatrick, Rose, McIlroy, Fleetwood, and Hovland, Åberg.
Yeah, Hovland, Åberg played in Wentworth together as well. To be fair, now, like, it's I think Donald, like, obviously, Jesus, he's had long enough to kind of sit on this, but Europe have a bit of an advantage in this side as well. Just talking about Wentworth and even some lads in the Irish Open, like, I think every European player on the Ryder Cup team has played at least once, maybe at least twice, in September. Whereas the US team, I think only two or three of them have actually played since August after the Tour Championship. So not only have they been out of competitive golf for a while, but it's also allowed Donald to kind of test out these pairings. Not test out these pairings, just test out, I guess, familiarity. Just relationship, just build it out on the golf course. And yeah, I think the Rahm Hatton is all but nailed in somehow. Not would never have put them together, but just two fucking, yeah, as you said, Joe, fiery personalities. It's great. That could be the
well, parent. I wouldn't know who Rahm is actually mates with. Like, Rahm kind of goes around all the time except Ryder Cup. I wouldn't say he's pally with anyone. Like, I've heard him kind of giving out a little bit about Rory and not being part of the old boys club or whatever. I always
bring, think Rahm. Bring Sergio back.
He's just pining for Sergio, yeah. Like, Jesus Christ, if I hear John Rahm whinging about Garcia once more, like, I'll lose it. Like, every time he brings up anything about the Ryder Cup, it's his little petulant Spaniard isn't there with him. Like, yesterday at his press conference, he was on the phone with Garcia, apparently. Like, so what? Like, your mates, you talk to each other. That's, like, I fail to see the relevance, but yeah, I mean, Rahm's obviously crucial for Europe, so finding him a partner is clearly going to be important. So if that is Hatton, then so be it. I mean, fiery can be good. There's no question about it if you can channel it in the right manner. And possibly more of a concern would be Hatton rather than Rahm, because I think Rahm, you know, seems to, well, I mean, clearly he's a superior player, but equally he's able to get his frustrations out and then just, you know, put it to one side and continue to play. I mean, I think it would be, for example, it would be difficult to see Tyrrell Hatton four putting the first green of a major and going on to put any sort of a performance together afterwards, that never mind win it. So I think I would have far less concern about Rahm. I think there's far more scope for chopping and changing on the European side, though. I think, like, I was looking this morning at the US possible foursomes, and I think they almost picked themselves, which in some ways is an excellent thing. I think the morning foursomes for the US, you're going to see Speed Thomas, Cantlay, Schauffele, Scheffler, Burns, and Koepka, Morikawa, possibly.
Koepka-Clark,
or it could possibly be even. I think Scheffler and Koepka are going to play together today, so that's another possibility. But like, there is, it does seem to be, you know, within that, I think you'd be surprised if at least three of those parents didn't play the first morning.
I can see Brian Harman getting out there in a foursomes. No, I mean,
oh, you see, actually, speaking of Harman, see, there was a video yesterday of him practicing on the range, and he's on the very far left of the range. The whole European team is in the middle, and the rest of the US team are on the very far side. So wow. he's either an antisocial prick or he's struggling with something.
I was reading a really interesting article about him in the last couple of days, and it was interesting for a couple of reasons. He said himself. So Brian Harman, I didn't know this, but got to world number one amateur. So when he came on tour, he kind of had pretty high expectations of himself. And then he had a pretty underwhelming career. And it was funny. He was describing how after tournaments, he would see kids asking for autographs and that type of thing. And he was going up and being polite and doing the autographs. But in his head, he felt embarrassed because he was like, these kids don't know who I am. I'm just a middle of the road tour pro. I'm signing these autographs and no one gives a shit about me or who I am. And to your point then, Cooper, he was kind of saying how, like, because he had been world number one amateur, he had very high expectations of himself when he got on tour, and he had a very underwhelming career on tour. And he was looking at all these other players, mates of his or guys that he was beating in college and all, that were surpassing him. And apparently he got a massive chip on his shoulder and he just became a really, like, angry, introverted person. And now that he's won the Open, he says, like, a weight has been lifted off him and all that sort of stuff. And he's probably becoming more pally. But he said, he called out Justin Thomas specifically, and he said he kind of hated Justin Thomas, that, like, he looked at this guy who'd come on and wins a couple of majors and wins everything. And he, by the sounds of it, was a little bit of a, I don't know if an asshole is too strong a word, but he didn't, he certainly wasn't pally with any of them. So what you just said there about him being separate in the range is interesting.
Yeah, he, like said, like Dave, of course, bang on with Cantlay, Schauffele, Speed Thomas, maybe Ricky slots in to win those four ball with the two lads. But then the Scheffler Burns, like, I totally get it. And the Texas Longhorn pairing or whatever, but they didn't do great in the President's Cup. So it'll be interesting to see if they do actually persist with that. But on Harman, like, if he is that kind of a person, like maybe someone like Brooks, like someone, a bit of a bomber off the tee, and then fits Harman's short game really well and vice versa. Then if Harman's relatively short off the tee and someone who can get there, maybe Koepka is the lone live ranger out there that might fit that kind of a personality. Not too sure, but yeah, he's or do you just put the two rookie Ryder Cup major champions out together? It's definitely going to be interesting. I think, speaking of Clark, I'm not sure they're actually going to put him with, but they could be again. Does Fowler slot in there somehow? But I think Clark could, like, he's 10th in the world now. He's not really, I don't know, if you asked a randomer where's Wyndham Clark in the world, you're not saying inside the top 20. He's sneaky good, and I think he's going to be a big factor in the US team. I don't think he's just there for a singles game and maybe slotting into one of the pairings.
I think he's come out and say he wants to play McIlroy. He openly said that. Yeah, so he's not short of confidence. No, I think him and Brooks are mates. I think they're mates from before, and there's talk of them as a pairing. But in foursomes, because apparently Scheffler and Brooks are lined up for four ball together. Now, this is all speculation, obviously, but Scheffler is a player that, you know, if he gets that putter going, and obviously we've probably all seen pictures of him on the putting green with Phil Kenyon. He's working with him now. He's got like a thicker grip on his putter, and I don't know, he's holding it more upright, but it's an ominous sign in some ways. It's probably actually, to be honest, it's a good sign, but it's if he gets that going, he'll play all five sessions. And yeah, it's like Dave said with Ram, it's important for them to pair him right. I think Burns fits in with him very well in the foursomes as well, because they're obviously very good mates, but Burns' putting stats are very good. He's up there. And I think looking at the setup of the, you know, the way the course is with the drivable par fours and the way the three par threes are uneven numbers, they can kind of dictate Scheffler's amount of, you know, putting on greens regulation he'll have to do. I think it's something like 4 versus 14 or 5 versus 13 or something that. So Burns will be able to take that many birdie putts if it goes to plan. And with Scheffler's long game, you would expect it to. So yeah, there's also talk of it being a very hilly course, and that, you know, do we know I'm playing five sessions, but like, these guys are athletes now as well. I don't see Scheffler, McIlroy, Rahm being rested if they're playing well after 36, 54 holes anyway. So the US one is interesting, but it's like arguably it's our best chance as well. If they get some of those pairings wrong, they could go pretty badly, I would say. Like if JT doesn't play well, that throws a bit of a spanner in the works, I'd say, for a few parents, because they'll need to figure out who
is Fowler. Not a kind of JT equivalent in terms of who they'd be pally with. Like I can see JT having a stinker. Like I know he'll get up for it and all that sort of stuff, but he's just not playing that well. So probably Ricky Fowler just slots in and plays with a JT partner. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You can see Smiley Kaufman coming in and playing well just because they're such good mates. Like, as in, I think JT is definitely, I think JT Spieth foursomes to kick it off. And then totally dependent on whether or not he's able to play golf anymore.
I JT can't see JT playing in. You reckon JT is going to play in a foursomes match?
I think they're going to put him out straight away.
Like, I'd say first. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
I think they're gonna double down on it. I think they're gonna take the chance and take it from there. Like he does, to be fair to him, he has an outstanding match play record, and stranger things have happened, and you see strange things happen in the likes of Ryder Cup. Like, you know, the fact that Ian Poulter was actually a top player, you know, for once every 2 years shows that really strange things can happen at the Ryder Cup. But you know, similar to Poulter, Thomas, you know, given his level of arrogance and brashness and just general nonsense, I mean, he'd be an asset to them as a cheerleader, if nothing else. Like, there's I have very little time for Justin Thomas at the best of times, but like, there is just something about him and team golf that really rubs me up the wrong way. So, I mean, I would
well shotgun a can of beer on the first tee.
I genuinely don't know if I've ever seen anything more disrespectful than Justin Thomas shotgunning a beer on the first tee for the Saturday afternoon session at that Ryder Cup. It was absolutely shocking. I find him absolutely insufferable when it comes to team golf. Like I would absolutely love it if he, like, I would Kevin Keegan rant love it if he crashed and burned at this Ryder Cup. It would be absolutely beautiful. But unfortunately, I don't know if he will. But at that being said, like, you know, there's all these kind of things that come out. Like, you know, Cooper, you mentioned Harman off on the range on his own yesterday. Like, I think Thomas did a lot of work after his round yesterday as well with the driver, something that he's really been struggling with. He has little to no form coming into it. I think, you know, he played reasonably well at the Fortinet Championship 2 weeks ago, which was the, you know, his tune-up. I still can't understand why he played that and not Wentworth. But anyway, that's his own That's his own lookout. But I mean, aside from that, what's he like missed 5 of 9 cuts coming into this? He's had a couple of absolute horror shows in majors this season. It is certainly a risk, but I think Johnson is going to double down on it, and he's going to play him with his good buddy Spieth on Friday morning in foursomes and take it from there. And possibly, you know, possibly it's not a bad move. Possibly he's just kind of going, well, look, that's 1 point. If he doesn't show up and play, so be it. We can drop him if it works out. And, you know, Spieth and Thomas storm off into a 4-3 victory or something. The knock-on impact of that for the team and for the rest of the week would be huge. So it's not necessarily the worst move in my mind. And I suppose the other key thing to remember is that Thomas hasn't had Zach Johnson praying for him all year. So there's a huge role for God to play in which Thomas shows up on Friday morning. So, I'd say Zach Johnson's rosary beads will be worn out by the end of the week.
He may have a group prayer session on the Friday morning before they all head out.
On the first tee, yeah, they'll all be all going over and rubbing his golf ball and stuff and trying to just get some energy into it and get him back to being, you know, because there's nothing that God would love more than to see an arrogant, obnoxious Justin Thomas strutting around Rome.
That'd be beautiful. That'd be a beautiful full circle from shotgun and cans to praying on the first tee. What bad golf will fucking do to you?
Yeah. What are we saying about Brooks? I know he's been mentioned already. Obviously, he won the PGA. He came second at the Masters to Rahm. But he hasn't played any good golf, I don't think, since his win at the PGA. I was actually looking at his LIV record. So he hasn't contended at a LIV record, a LIV event since July. His last couple of starts have actually been pretty bad. I mean, look, you can't write him off, big time player, all that sort of stuff. But yeah, what do you think? Does Brooks get much action this week?
As far as bad as LIV golf is an indicator for fucking actual golf results. How many people are in LIV golf? 48, right?
Mm.
He's been 38, 38, and 24th in his 3 starts since the Open on LIV golf. I just don't think
he's getting up for that, though. I just think he'll be up for this. Majors and World Cups are different. I think
totally
he hasn't lost.
At the same time, when you're playing against Graham McDowell and there's only fucking 14 lads finishing behind you, half of which were decent amateurs that got robbed of their fucking golfing career by a bit of cash. But there's still, you have to be a decent, like McIlroy couldn't give a fuck about some of these events and he'll still squander into the top 10 because he's that good. And if Koepka can't do this on fucking courses set up for birdies, I just don't see how you can trust that form. And like, it's a bit, if he does put him out on Friday, which I don't think he won't put him out in the foursomes, I don't think. Just because I don't think there's a perfect match for him, really. Like the talk about him and Harman, maybe it comes to fruition, but I just don't see. I think there's far more compelling pairings in the US team than Brooks and someone else. But when he does come in, you're right, Joe. Like he is, but at the same time, majors obviously his bread and butter. Does he give a fuck about the Ryder Cup? In all fair, like if he didn't.
I think he's gonna up for it,
but like as far as Ryder Cups go, I don't know. Does he give a shit about America? Does he give a shit about anything other than those 4 tournaments a year? I just can't see Brooks getting psyched up for a Ryder Cup the same way he would for a major. And does that mean he plays like it's a non-major? And
I just wonder, does he feel like he's got a point to prove? And when Koepka has a point to prove, he's a dangerous animal. And the point being, you know, I can go to live and I can swan around, you know, whatever event they had on last weekend, and I can show up at a different time to the rest of the team. And also, I'm that good that even without playing nearly, you know, half as many events as you guys have played that have been eligible for Ryder Cup, I can still qualify for the team kind of thing and show up and play. So I think Koepka will have a different mindset this week than he possibly has had in other Ryder Cups. I think his Ryder Cup record's modest. I think it's more or less 50-50. Yeah. Over the course of his time playing. So you know, he's not someone that like would stand out as historically being a huge threat, but like, you know, McIlroy's Ryder Cup record is literally 50-50 as well, so over the course of his six or seven Ryder Cups to date. So, you know, I think Koepka, I take your point, Cooper, in terms of does he really care about anything other than himself? But I think that there is a Brooks Koepka motivation there that's probably outside just actually winning the Ryder Cup and that showing that, you know, not only can I go to live and just swan around us and I can still come back and win a major, and also I can come and contribute to winning Ryder Cups.
I think it's not an American thing. It's not a team thing that will get him fired up. I think it's very much a Brooks Koepka thing that he, exactly as you described, he will look at this and see this as a chance for him to peacock and to show everyone what he can do, rather than, the European angle where they get fired up because it's a team thing.
I wonder if anyone wants to play him on Sunday. Like, I would say he arguably is probably the most feared of the, you know, the European guys on Sunday. And you could see him going number 12 if it's tight going into it, but you could easily see him going, look, just put me out first, I'm going to win the point. And Zach Johnson would probably be a fool not to believe him if he says that as well.
With a prayer. What are we saying in terms of captains? So Zach Johnson, we know, loves God, but two-time major winner, probably an understated kind of guy. Luke Donald, former world number one, no majors, but great Ryder Cup record. I always look at Luke Donald and think he's a bit of a baby-faced assassin, very calculated guy. I always quite like Luke Donald. How much weight do we put on the captains in the Ryder Cup?
Well, poor Johnson, like, obviously the team nearly selects itself. There was obviously a few kind of guys on the fence, but as far as Donald has had a tough time figuring this thing out. And 6 months ago when it was handed to him after Stenson defected, it was a bit of a basket case. And it just, not only did it kind of look not bad for the Ryder Cup, but Liv kind of statistically or very tactically poached the Ryder Cup captain and probably gave him a good bit of money for it. But it was, he was kind of thrown in about halfway through. Really kind of who's even going to be on this team, and kind of a lot of work to do then, not only figuring out a team, but figuring out a team that's going to work around this course, and then having the advantage of being able to set up that course. So maybe that might have helped a small bit in terms of I can do a few things here. But Joe said it earlier on, like there's three par fives, they're all reachable, there's three drivable par fours, the par threes are not holes. Like it's very, very tactical, I'd say, when it comes down to actually what way am I going to play this team. But if Zach Johnson goes and wins it, he had the American team. He's like, I guess it's an away Ryder Cup. They haven't won there in 30 years. Not much is going to be expected, especially after last time out. Maybe there is a lot of expectation there. But at the same time, it's very hard to win in Europe. Like, just sorry, lads, but I hope whoever comes here and for a day or manner in 27 can do a better job. But if Luke Donald pulls it out of the bag, I think it'll be an amazing, like McGinley-esque kind of captain's performance. So there's probably a lot more pressure on him. But if he does pull it off, it'll be an incredible achievement.
I think the Ryder Cup captaincy is one of the most overplayed things in sport, to be honest. I think there's a huge amount of talk about who's a good captain or who's a bad captain, and you know, people relate to people, you know, in certain ways, and I'm sure that is important, and I'm sure like the setup and the planning and the strategy is important, but ultimately the difference between a good Ryder Cup captain and a bad Ryder Cup captain is the form of his team that week, and you just don't want to make any howlers. Like, you just don't want to pull a Hal Sutton and put Mickelson and Tiger out together when it comes to your pairings. And you just want to make it, as much of a team atmosphere as possible. But I do think that it is quite overplayed, and you could be like the best Ryder Cup captain of all time and just have 12 players that aren't in form. Like, I don't think, for example, I heard much negative press about Harrington as a captain, yet he unfortunately oversaw a record defeat 2 years ago because he just came up against a US team that was like a buzzsaw, and you know, his own star players didn't show up for him, and that was it, and it wouldn't matter whether he was, you know, the best or worst Ryder Cup captain in Europe or never winning that week.
I think Harrington couldn't have done much in 21 in Whistling Straits. I think there was no pairing that you'd sort of like jump out straight away, like you said with Hal Sutton, with that shocker. But there was no pairing that he failed with. I think he played everyone within the first two sessions as well. And, you know, McGinley's always hailed for that as well in 2014. But I think, you know, Whistling Straits had notoriously wide fairways in 2021. And in terms of being, I think, set up of a course is definitely an advantage. Maybe less so if this European team went to Whistling Straits, but the year that it was two years ago with the likes of Poulter and Westwood and our team, there was nothing we could do about that. So I think having captains that are sort of quiet is not a bad thing as well. Like, they're not trying to take the limelight. I think that's probably a good thing for the teams. They can just let the players kind of do the talking and see what happens. And I'm sure, look, the vice captains are doing a bit in the background, as we said, with Eduardo Molinari. I'm sure the Italians will be more on board with the European team, given Francesco and Eduardo are in the backroom staff. But yeah, it comes down to the players, really. It definitely comes down to them.
I think if you're an exceptional captain somehow, I think that can make a bit of a difference. Let's say McGinley is the pinnacle 2014. And I think if you're a really shit captain, that can make a difference. But I think 90% of the time you're in that middle ground. Now, to Cooper's point, given how much more data and stats driven everything is now, the decision making does come into it a little bit more probably now than they were able to years ago. And I think the big thing for the captain is just to create an atmosphere amongst the team.
Yeah, I think that's the key thing. I think it's really overplayed. I mean, like, you've used McGinley there as an outstanding captain. Do you know McGinley's an outstanding captain because of things that he did, or because he told you that he's an outstanding captain? Because I know it because McGinley has told me for the last 9 years how good he was.
I know what you're saying, and that is true. McGinley has been boastful without trying, well, whatever way he's been. But it does seem by all accounts that he did do a very good job. I mean, getting Alex Ferguson in, doing little things throughout the course of the week that seemed to work very well and creating a good atmosphere.
But again, exactly. That's he's building the culture around it.
I don't remember Alex Ferguson holding any putts in the 2014 Ryder Cup. I must have missed that.
That's a Man City fan coming through there. 100%.
I don't remember Pep Guardiola holding any putts in 2018 when he was at the Ryder Cup.
Is Pep Guardiola a good manager?
Well, no, that's a completely different argument. And let's not descend into absolute nonsense. Like, I mean, come on, if you're going to compare Paul McGinley to Pep Guardiola, I think we might as well just log off and let's never record another podcast.
But like, you have to even from like whatever you want to say about McGinley, but like in terms of something that is far less weight in the Ryder Cup, in the President's Cup, Immelman has done a great job trying to muster some sort of a fucking team out of something that just isn't a team. And it's that kind of, I guess, just building some sort of a rapport between these players that they're actually playing for something. And yeah, like, there's obviously, like, as you said, Con, data. Like, but the problem with heaps of data is afterwards, if he makes a bad decision, here's three other decisions you should have made based on the data. Like, there's always patterns. Like, humans find patterns, and whether it's after a win or a loss, we'll find some sort of excuse, especially when there's an absolute mountain of data to back any kind of decision up. But no, it's just, it's about, yeah, building a bit of team spirit and, I guess, trying to not let the Brooks Koepka egos get in there and trying to actually say, right, you're doing this for something a bit bigger. Even if it's tough for, like, Seve, like, encapsulated that for Europe. It's like, it's a European team. It's a fuck the Yanks kind of thing. And yeah, it's easier as American, and they can shotgun beers on the first and do whatever they want to do and fucking freedom. But like for Europe, then they do need they need someone to actually bring them together beyond the kind of, I guess, the country borders, which like no one says they're European. But for 1 week every 2 years, that's the captain's job to make people feel like that.
Yeah, I do agree with that. And Europe have clearly just been better at doing that. Yeah, I don't know. The captain's thing is just an interesting one. I can see both sides of it. Before we kind of come to a wrap up, the Solheim Cup will have given the lads a bit of inspiration last week. Great for the Europeans to get the job done. Leona with another great performance, taking out Rosang in the singles. Dave, yeah, pretty cool event.
Yeah, if the Ryder Cup is you know on the same level on Sunday, we're in for a real treat. Solheim Cup was absolutely brilliant from all the, it was everything you would want from a team event. You know, there was plenty of drama, plenty of good golf, and plenty of atmosphere and action. I think, you know, it's always a bit disappointing, I think, when it finishes 14 apiece and the holders retain. I mean, I've seen a lot of suggestions on social media this week as to how to fix that, and I'm not sure it necessarily needs to be fixed, but it is a little bit of a, I'm not going to say an anticlimax, but you know, there is no clear winner, but the holders get the credit for winning it.
What would this suggest? Just out of curiosity, what suggestions did you see on social media? Because I think that is an interesting one.
Like the all sorts of things, like, you know, a team nominates a player at the beginning of the week, and if it does end up a tie, those players face off in like a 3 or 4 hole playoff or something, which would be
interesting. How cool would that be? That would be absolute drama.
It would be good, but it would also be, you know, be quite contrived in certain ways. I think, you know, it's the way it's been for a long time, and it's not something that happens all that often. So, you know, just because, you know, the Americans are a little bit sore that they couldn't win the Solheim away, and Europe have, you know, held it or won it, whatever way you want to look at it, for the last 3 years, doesn't necessarily mean that you need to just change the whole structure of the game. But you know, the fact that they lost, if you said to the Europeans at Friday lunchtime when they'd lost the morning session 4-0 that they'd end up tying 14-all and retain the cup, I think they would have taken your hands off. And even at one point, you know, it was more or less 14-11 to the US, and you know, the fact that Europe were able to turn some of those matches, I think, like, you know, it was mentioned earlier that Hedwall didn't get a look in until the Saturday afternoon session. You know, she was 3 down with 6 to play, birdied 5 of her last 6 holes to turn her match around. And if she doesn't do that, Europe don't win the cup. It's as simple as that. You know, there was some excellent golf on both sides. And then, you know, just when it looked like things were starting to slip away from the Europeans on Sunday, and, you know, Hedwall obviously stepping up, and then Saganda, the 2 shots that she played into 16 and 17 under that level of pressure is just incredible. Like the tee shot on 17 has been the one that's been bandied around all week on social media, but like Korda had stuck in her own second shot on 16 to about 10 foot, and for Saganda to follow her in and get inside her was just superb under the pressure. And then poor Alexi was doing her best to throw away her point, but somehow managed to hold it together on 17 to win it and make sure it ended up being a tie. So probably best for everyone that Lexi didn't collapse altogether.
I don't think I've ever seen a golfer with a better reputation for a collapse than poor Lexi Thompson. She's still a young woman, but
well, it's well earned, and it's well earned and hard earned. I feel sorry for her because she clearly has a problem dealing with pressure. I mean, like the Friday 4-ball match, when after Leona had chipped in for Lexi Shank, I don't know if everyone saw it, but it's worth looking at. I mean, it's painful stuff. Like, it's when you look at the two stills of where her third shot was versus where her fourth shot was, like if you didn't see the video of the chip, you'd have some job working out what actually happened to end up in place four, having started at place three. But you know, she was put into the cauldron by her captain. She was put in number 12, and it was nearly going to come down to her. As I say, as it turns out, she was able to secure the tie for the US. But it was nearly going to come down. So clearly they do have some faith in her, or either that, or just some sort of, there's some sort of like sick joke amongst the Americans where they just love to see Lexi fuck up.
Unmentionables on the 15th on Sunday as well, before she went and hit those two shots.
Yeah, makes it even more impressive. But I suppose actually just on that point, Joe, like that wasn't shown on TV. Like I thought the coverage was absolutely atrocious. And I think Sky Sports have said that they were taking it from an international provider and it wasn't actually their feed. But if the coverage this week for the Ryder Cup is by the same provider, it's going to be a tough watch. Like, it was very difficult to follow at times on Sunday. Like, Hedwall, as an example, like, being three down with six to play, at one point it felt like she was three down, and then, you know, that game was over, and then next thing she was holding a putt to go all square. They didn't show Saganda. Well, if they did show Saganda's shank on 15, they certainly didn't show it in any sort of real time. I think it just looked like she had a putt for a double or something, and you were kind of like, what's after?
Yeah, they didn't show it. They didn't show it at all. And also when Saganda held the putt to retain, there was still a match going on behind that could have dictated the outcome of the Solheim Cup, and they spent 10 minutes on the green showing the celebrations. And even McGinley and the commentary was sort of, you could tell he was a bit frustrated. He was like, yeah, I wonder what's going on down 16.
The whole 100%.
Because I think Pedersen had won a hole back, I think.
Pedersen had won the last two holes. That was like Lexi was doing her best. If Pedersen had won, I think they ended up halving 16. So Lexi was two up with two to play. But if Pedersen had won 16, like it was, because it goes back to the original point of like the difference between winning and tying or drawing. Is massive, like, and that was the key game in that respect. But also, like, even the graphic, like, they had to explain on commentary that Saganda's putt wasn't to win the Solheim Cup, it was to retain it.
McGinley had to correct that as well. He was raging with the whole situation.
That is so
cool. Yeah. The other thing, I don't know what your take on this would be or anyone's take on this would be, but like the music on the first tee, like, for I get it to a point. And maybe it's all well and good on Friday and Saturday when there's four matches going on. But like when they were putting 12 matches out on the Sunday, like, and like the first match would be on like the 11th or 12th by the time the last match tees off. So you've watched at least 2.5 hours of golf, and all you can hear in the background is like dance music blaring. It felt very live, or it felt like it was making, like, as I say, all for a bit of atmosphere in the first tee, but when you can still hear it blaring around the course and through the coverage, it kind of made it feel a little less important to me. I hope that was something that they were just doing for the Solheim Cup, and it's not something that's going to translate over to the Ryder Cup this week.
My thoughts on that are, it's forcing something that the crowd should be the ones that are generating that atmosphere, and I think Ryder
Cup will be the 100%. Case.
And I think it will be as well. Like, it'd be like a boxer going out, and instead of just having an opening song, the song keeps playing throughout the match or throughout the fight. Like, it's not, the crowd are there to generate that atmosphere. And yeah, it's if that kind of crack is going on, it's literally, oh, we have to do this. The lads in fucking Ria are doing this. It's like, no, lads, like, this is the biggest event of the lads' career this week, and the biggest event of the girls' career last week. In terms of team golf, so fucking, you don't need any external catalyst to fucking make it a good event.
Yeah, right. We should bring this to a close. To round it off, will we do just quick predictions? Who do you think is going to win, and maybe a little score? Cooper, what are you saying? Ryder Cup, Europe, USA, give it to me.
Yeah, it's going to be very, very close. Like it could be a spectacular kind of week of golf, and please, please God, it is. But yeah, I'm going for Europe 14.5 to US 13.5. Wow. Right down lower.
Joe.
Yeah, we're definitely due a close one. I think the last one was Medina. But there's been a few where the final day, you know, the last kind of four or five singles matches have been academic kind of. So yeah, hopefully, as with the Solheim Cup last weekend, it's a close one. So yeah, I'll say I'm gonna go Europe. I'm more confident as the days go on, and I'll say 15-13 Europe.
Okay, I'm actually going to say the exact same. I think 15-13 Europe. Like, it's one of those things, obviously, it's just hard to predict, and I know it's who knows in the end, but I do slightly fancy Europe, but I do think it's going to be tight. I'd be surprised if it's a blowout. So I'm going to say 15-13 Europe. Dave?
Yeah, I've been singing the virtues of a European victory for a good few weeks now, and while I'd love to play devil's advocate just for the sake of it, I'm not going to. But I do, fortunately or unfortunately, whatever way you want to look at it, I do think the best way for Europe to win this is to have a sizable enough lead going into Sunday. You know, I'm kind of thinking 10-6, 9.5, 6.5 kind of territory. So I'm going to go a little bit stronger on the score. I'm going to say 16-12. Which doesn't necessarily mean that it won't be close, but I just think it, like, I wouldn't call that blowout territory, but I do think that the Europeans, if they are going to win it, are going to need a reasonably big lead going into Sunday, because I just think that, historically speaking, the depth of the US side has shone through in singles play, and I think that will be the case again this year. So I wouldn't be surprised to see European win with the US taking the singles, so therefore Europe needing a pretty big lead going in. And then my side bet for the week is Justin Thomas just being an absolute melt the entire time.
I think you're odds on for that. So
yeah,
I wouldn't give you great odds on that. Okay, cool. Well, I enjoyed that. I'm buzzing. Like, Ryder Cup only rocks around every 2 years. Cooper, I'm jealous of you being there. So you're going to be a course marshal, Cooper. You're going to be there just like waving flags and looking for golf balls and
hoping a few. Let's just stop oil protesters around the course. I can go for them. On the fifth. So keep an eye out for any action.
Lovely. Okay. Cool. Well, hope everyone enjoys Ryder Cup, enjoys Rome, everything that comes with it, the build up, the event. Let's pray for a tight one. Let's pray for some tension. I was putting some content earlier on about the war on the shore in 91 and Brookline 99. I'd love if a couple of lads started coming to blows. John Rahm went and headbutted Scotty Scheffler or something would be good. But probably pretty unlikely. But anyway, on that note, yeah, enjoy it all. And yeah, we'll speak soon.